All right, I think we're ready for this fourth lecture in our series, and I'm going to be turning to Psalm 19 as a beginning place. We've begun each of these lectures with a passage of Scripture. This seems very fitting also to tell the story of the approach we're taking in this series. Psalm 19, verse 1 says, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows His handiwork. Day unto day utters speech. Night unto night reveals knowledge. There is no speech nor language. Their voice is not heard. Their line has gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world." And so, that testimony says that the natural world speaks about the existence of God. In this series of lessons, what we're doing is turning our attention to the evidence of the natural world, and we're trying to demonstrate that the best interpretation of that evidence is that there has been an intelligent designer who brought these things about. So that's our approach in this series. We appreciate your being with us throughout it. I'm turning it aside, of course, from that book that I just read from to what I believe is God's other book, The Evidence of the Natural World. And so let's begin. As you can see on the screen before you, this lesson is designed to deal with the fossil record, which I will say to you in this same article I referred to earlier by Stephen Jay Gould, taken from Discover Magazine. Remember he said, "Our confidence in the fact of evolution rests upon copious data that fall roughly into three great classes." Now, if this were my regular class, I would be giving you a quiz right now and asking you to remember what that first great class of evidence was that we discussed in the last lecture. The first great class was small-scale changes, you remember? And he said they're represented in laboratory experiments, they're represented in nature, and they're represented in breeding. And I tried to show you that Stephen Jay Gould's first great class of evidence is much better interpreted from an intelligent design perspective. It does not form a great line of evidence for the general theory of evolution, in my opinion. Go back and listen to that if you weren't here. Now he says there's a second great class of evidence. Let's look carefully at what he says as you look at this quote with me. He says, "Second, we have the direct evidence for large-scale changes based upon sequences in the fossil record." Now I want to stop right there and disagree with that quote also. Fossil record is not direct evidence, ladies and gentlemen. He says we have the direct evidence for large-scale changes. The fossil record is not direct evidence for large-scale changes. It's indirect evidence for large-scale changes. Because what do you see in the fossil record? You see fossils. You don't see fossils changing. You see a record of fossils recorded in the ground. You can conclude from that there have been large-scale changes based on examining the fossils. That is not direct evidence, ladies and gentlemen. It's indirect. So that's my first correction to Dr. Gould's statement here. Then he says, based upon sequences in the fossil record. You have to be a little bit careful about that, as I will show you. Because sequences in the fossil record are not always as clear as they're portrayed. You would think from listening to some of these folks that you could go someplace on earth and just dig down in the ground and there it is. The whole sequence is just laid out for you. It's never that simple, ladies and gentlemen. It's never that simple. The nature of this evidence is often misunderstood by non-professionals who view evolution as a simple ladder of progress and therefore expect a linear array of missing links. He's almost making fun of us. That we just don't understand. We think you need a linear array of missing links in the fossil record. Well, no, I just like something. And when I finish talking to you today, I think you will see why many evolutionists say that the fossil record is not at all the best line of evidence. They wouldn't even include it in their 1, 2, 3 great classes, as you'll see when I get finished. But don't take my word for it. You go read for yourself. But Dr. Gould says this is his second great class of evidence, the fossil record. That's why I want to talk to you about it today. So I have a couple of quotes here. One is from G.A. Kirkut in his book Implications of Evolution. And Dr. Kirkut, I like very much. He's an evolutionist, but he's an honest man, and he's willing to state the way it really is. Here's what he says. The most important evidence for the theory of evolution is that obtained from the study of paleontology. Paleontology is the study of fossils. Though the study of other branches of zoology, such as comparative anatomy or embryology, might lead one to suspect that animals are interrelated. Did we talk a little about comparative anatomy earlier? Yes, we did. And we even talked about comparative biochemistry, didn't we? He says those might lead you to suspect that all animals are interrelated. It was the discovery of various fossils and their correct placing in relative strata and age that provided the main factual basis for the modern view of evolution. Somebody has said fossils are their only real hard facts. That's a joke. They are hard, and they are facts. But do they really support the theory of evolution well? That's the question. Dr. Kirkut says they are the most important evidence for the general theory. But do you notice something that he said here? The discovery of various fossils and their correct placing in relative strata and age. That's interesting, isn't it? I thought they were just there. You have to place them. Well, there is an element of truth to the fact that you have to place them. Because the fact is, there is no place on earth where you find them all. So you have to correlate different places on earth in the fossil record to come up with the correct placing and relative strata. Now, an evolutionist would argue with you that we can do that placing rather carefully by the proper techniques. But the fact is, there is no place on earth where you find the whole fossil record, folks. So there's an inference going on here. All right, here's another interesting quote. This is from Stan Weidberg in his reviews of 31 creationist books. Came out in 1984. Here's what Weinberg says. Fossils do not provide the best supportive evidence for evolution. The fields of biochemical genetics, comparative anatomy, comparative biochemistry, embryology, and biogeography provide much stronger evidence. So he would argue that there's much better evidence elsewhere. So it depends on who you talk to. Stan Weidberg is an absolute confirmed Bible-toting evolutionist, if I may call it that. I mean, he absolutely believes the evolutionary viewpoint, but he doesn't believe the fossil record is the best evidence. I think you will see why he would say that by the time we finish this discussion. So what is a fossil? Good question. Here's an example of one. This is a Dinornithus brachiopod. Looks like a what? Looks like a seashell, doesn't it? By the way, we've been allowing people to speak out. This is a class. Here's a Dinornithus brachiopod fossil broken open. Isn't that interesting? That's solid rock, people. And it's preserved, basically, the characteristic features of that organism inside that shell. You can find lots of those. Let's not argue about this. If you argue with facts, you're going to lose. There are lots of fossils. Lots of them. You can find them most places on Earth. So there's a fossil. What's a fossil then? I like Colin Patterson's answer to that question. A fossil is a mess on a rock. I want to introduce you to Colin Patterson. Colin Patterson was the curator of the British Museum of Natural History for many years. Another one of these feisty characters. He's thoroughly convinced evolution is correct. But he doesn't mind speaking out against it. Just every now and then. And he gets himself in all kinds of hot water over it. But I really like him a lot because he doesn't mind bucking the tide of the common view. Fossil is a mess on a rock. That's a pretty good description of a fossil. So, you see that fossil right there? That's a trilobite trapped in a rock. and it's rockified itself. I mean, it's hard as a rock. So a fossil is a mess on a rock. Here's a better definition. It comes from the little book of Pandas and People I presented to you this morning. I sure recommend that book to you for young people. Fossils are rock replicas of plants or animals or their parts, especially their skeletons, and they provide us a link with the past. The morphology of an animal, that is, its shape, including its skeleton, is an elaboration of the information content of its DNA, and hence, fossils are capsules of information from past life forms. That's good. Capsules of information from past life forms. It could literally be a mess on a rock, people. It could be the remains of something that an animal gave off and left behind. Do you understand what I'm saying? I'm trying to be gentle with this. Yeah, that's right. It can be all kinds of things, leftovers from the past. That's a fossil. All right. What would you expect to find in the fossil record if the evolutionary view were correct? I'm going to let Darwin answer this question himself. And guess where I'm taking this quote from? The Origin of Species. Let me pause here just a moment and say a few words about this book. First of all, how many of you in this audience have read this book, On the Origin of Species? One person. May I suggest to you that if you really want to dig into this subject, this is the first book you ought to read. Because, folks, this is the book that turned the world. It truly is. In this sense, Darwin is the one that's credited with giving the evolutionary view scientific respectability. And it's interesting that the great majority of his book, Darwin was a master at taking something negative and turning it into something positive. And here's how he did it. He himself presented in this book all the bad things about his theory. Not all of them, but a lot of them. So he would say, for example, if you think about this, this is terrible for my theory. And then he would proceed to explain why it wasn't terrible. So he'd present the problems, and then he'd explain the problems away. Well, you see, what that does is it gets you to where even the negatives become a positive. That's not a bad approach. I really think it's a sign also of a man who was honest enough with himself that he recognized the challenges of his own theory. I like this book. Not because of the effect it's had, but because I do think it was presented by an honest man. So on this particular subject, on the fossil record, did you know that in 1859 there had hardly been any fossils discovered at all of any significance? And there wasn't a single fossil discovered at that time that anybody recognized as having to do with human lineage. So he had really had nothing to go on with regard to that in terms of the fossil record. Now, there had been fossils found, but there wasn't anything like we have today. So you're thinking now, 150 years ago, and here's what he said. Remember, he believes in the general theory of evolution that all living things came from a common ancestry over long periods of time by small-scale changes. You got that picture? Then he says, the number of intermediate varieties which have formerly existed on Earth must be truly enormous. Wouldn't you agree with that? If his theory is correct, shouldn't there be all kinds of records of intermediates? Gradations from one thing into another? You would think so. Why, then, is not every geological formation and every stratum full of such intermediate links? Geology assuredly does not reveal any such finely graduated organic chain. And this, perhaps, is the most obvious and gravest objection which can be urged against my theory. And may I say that here in 2008, I exactly do that. I urge this upon you as one of the most serious and gravest objection to Darwin's theory. It is worse today than it was in 1859, not better. The situation we find ourselves in is that this particular line of evidence is destructive to his theory, in this man's opinion. And if I were presenting this as a court case before a jury, like you're supposed to be my jury, I believe I could win the case. Well, let's talk about it a little bit. Darwin himself said, the geologic record of fossils does not support my view. Then how did he go on and explain it away? Here's what he said back then. He said the record was too imperfect. He said we haven't found them yet. And so what happened, I'll tell you this, after that book was published, folks went scattering all over this world to find fossils. And we had the biggest fossil hunting expeditions that have ever happened in the history of mankind. Everybody was looking for fossils to support that theory. And since that time, we have found literally millions and millions and millions of fossils, people. There are so many fossils that they're lying in various museums of natural history in their basements because nobody has time to get to them. I'm talking thousands upon thousands of fossils that have never been studied because they can't find time to do it. So don't tell me there aren't a lot of fossils now. There are literally more than we can deal with. So that argument doesn't hold any water anymore. The evidence the evolutionist needs to establish his claims is fossils showing a gradual, step-by-step development of lower animal life into more and more complex forms. Doesn't that make sense? That's what you'd expect. That's what Darwin said. For example, if this amphibian evolved into that bird, wouldn't you find all kinds of intermediates leading from one to the other? Nobody believes an amphibian, boom, became a bird. No. The evolutionary theory says there were small-scale changes over long periods of time that nature selected till eventually you produced something that was like a bird. Well, if that's the case, shouldn't we be able to find in the fossil record a pretty good indication of how that happened? That's what Darwin thought. That's what I think. The evidence needed to support creation is fossil showing complex life appearing suddenly, with no fossil evidence of lower animals developing in the new complex life forms. It seems to me if creation happened, then what happened is, boom, suddenly these things appear. And there's not evidence of how anything led up to them. That's what you'd expect, wouldn't it? Wouldn't it be? Now, I want to confess to you right here, because I want to be as honest as I know how to be. There are things about the fossil record I don't know how to explain from a creationist standpoint. You listening? I don't have all the answers to this. But I think the basic fundamental features of the fossil record that everybody agrees on do not support the general theory. They better support distinct, sudden appearance of complex forms. That's what they support. And that supports the intelligent design view, in my opinion. But are there things about the fossil record that are hard and challenging for me? Oh, absolutely. There are. I'm going to keep studying. So here I'd like for the next few minutes to present to you the notable features of the fossil record. I have presented this series of lectures in lots of places in front of many geologists. I'm not a geologist. I confess to you that up also at the beginning. This is a weak area for me. I'm reading after other people. But I have confirmed what I'm telling you with numbers of folks who are experts. So, with that proviso, let's go on. First feature. The fossil record is filled with fossils, which encapsulate information. Did you know there was a time when Christians denied there were any such thing as fossils? Folks, I've told you how many times in this series, if you argue with facts, you're going to lose. The fact is, there are millions of fossils. See, I wrote some figures down here. At present, it is claimed that over 250,000 fossil species have now been cataloged. Over 250,000 fossil species. Now, that's an interesting subject. Boy, we could spend another whole day on that. How do you decide that this fossil is a different species from that fossil? Did you know that one of the definitions of species is this population doesn't interbreed with that one? Well, how do you make fossils breed? That's a problem. You can't base your definition of a fossil species on whether it's going to breed or not. So what you have to do is base it on what it looks like. That's the best you can do. Characteristics. But deciding that this is a different fossil species from this, may I present to you this problem? It's a great challenge, and even experts disagree on it. Is this new fossil you found, is it a new species or isn't it? It's a really challenging thing. It's a little aside here, thrown in free of charge. But one of the characteristic features of the fossil record is there's lots of fossils, and they encapsulate information from the past. Based on all those fossils, men have constructed what is called the geologic column, which is found in every college textbook on geology and on biology, paleontology. Here's the basic picture. What has been constructed, this is modern times up here, and if you trace backward in time, you're going farther and farther down in the earth, supposedly, and so the Quaternary is the most modern age, part of the Cenozoic, the Tertiary, the Cretaceous, going into the Mesozoic period of history, the Jurassic. Everybody's familiar with that one, aren't you? From the famous movie Jurassic Park. About what? Dinosaurs. And so you see over here the dinosaurs in the Jurassic period. And the Triassic, Permian, Carboniferous, Devonian, Silurian, Ordovician, and Cambrian. Those are the fundamental periods that they've divided fossil record up into. How many are there? Let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Usually it's said to be 10 because these two are usually lumped together. So you have 10 fundamental periods. The lowest of which is the Cambrian period. Below that is called Precambrian. And you can see, generally speaking, that from the Cambrian period on up, you have less complex fossils. And the farther you go up, you have more complex fossils. Okay? The general trend in the fossil record is that. And I have to say to you, that's one of the challenges I have as a creationist, to explain that, generally speaking, the lower you go down in the earth, the less complex fossils you find. Generally speaking. It's not 100%. But generally speaking, some creationists explain that by saying the Noahic flood accounts for all that. I must tell you, I've studied that subject rather deeply, and I don't see that the flood of Noah can account for all this. That's my opinion. I think that's too simplistic an explanation to account for all the stuff you find in the fossil record. So that is not satisfying to me to account for everything I see. You study it for yourself. But a creationist needs to come up with some kind of an explanation why that's the general pattern. And that's an area I don't have a complete answer for you. So I look at other things that I think are more important in terms of deciding between the two views. By the way, this picture right here is completely misleading, because this Cambrian layer doesn't just have little old creatures like that, as you'll see in just a minute. Here's another problem. The geologic time column does not exist anywhere on Earth. Geology book by von Engen and Castor said, if a pile were to be made by using each geologic age, it would be at least 100 miles high. Here's what they mean by that. Some places on Earth you're going to find a large Cambrian layer. Other places you'd hardly find any. But if you put together the largest portions of the layers that they've identified somewhere on Earth and you stacked them all up, it would be at least 100 miles high. That's the point. Well, so they said the column doesn't exist anywhere on Earth. It's a construct made by men. Do you know what the deepest canyon, one of the deepest canyons on Earth is? Grand Canyon. You know how deep it is, roughly, at the deepest place? It's about a mile. Some say a mile and a half. So the Grand Canyon, which is one of our deepest canyons that you can go down into and observe all these layers, is about a mile and a half deep at the deepest point. So if the total layers is about 100 miles, and we have a deep canyon that has about a mile and a half, how much are we missing? Like, how about 98.5%? Now, it is also true that oil companies make oil drillings that go down into the earth, sometimes up to 30 to 35,000 feet. And they bring up core samples that contain fossils. Some of them, I'm told, in exploratory drillings can drill up to 100,000 feet. What is that, 20 miles? So there are drillings that go that deep, and they can bring up core samples that contain fossils in them. So we have gotten down pretty deep in the earth, but not 100 miles, folks. There is nowhere on earth where you can just go down and say, all right, and it's all labeled. Here's the Permian, here's the Triassic, here's the Jurassic. No. You have to put it together from different places on earth. Here's what Stephen A. Austin says, a geologist who is, by the way, a creationist, but very well respected in the field. Data from continents and ocean basins show that the 10 systems are poorly represented on a global scale. Approximately 77% of the Earth's surface area on land and under the sea has seven or more of the stratosystems missing. Are you with me? Out of those 10 systems, most places on Earth have at least seven missing. 94% of the Earth's surface has at least three or more systems missing beneath, and an estimated 99.6% has at least one missing. So I'm telling you, there's no place on Earth where you can find the geologic column. So this picture that you have in books, and may I please ask you to do this always, distinguish between facts and interpretations. This picture is not a fact, it's an interpretation of facts. Now, do people have a lot of trust in it? Yes, they do. Do you know that oil companies send their geologists out to search for where you can find oil, and they base it upon the geologic column? And do they strike oil? They do, a lot of times. So folks have confidence in this thing. I'm not saying it's not useful. Just don't tell me it's a fact. It's an interpretation of facts. You have to put it together. All right. Secondly, there are hundreds of locations known that do not match this order. They're out of order. As the old black preacher used to say, out of order! Stratosystems are believed in some places to be inverted, repeated, or inserted where they do not belong. Says Dr. Austin, overturning, overthrust, faulting, or landsliding are frequently maintained as disrupting the order. You know, sometimes in this massive movement of the earth, you can get overthrusting, where lower layers are thrust over on top of the higher ones. So you get the wrong order. So sometimes there's evidence for that. In some locations, such structural changes can be supported by the physical evidence, while elsewhere, physical evidence of disruption may be lacking and special pleading may be required using fossils or radiometric dating. So there are dating methods that are used. I have chosen, ladies and gentlemen, not to discuss dating methods in this series of lectures. If you want to ask some questions about it, I'll be glad to talk about it later, but I've chosen not to take time in my lectures to discuss it, because it's a little bit complicated. It requires some heavy math. We'll get back to that another day, maybe. Second, major feature of the fossil record, early origin of the phyla. Nobody disagrees with this, folks. This is absolutely established. Let me show you. Here's the Cambrian and the Precambrian. Everybody knows that at the Cambrian layer, as men have described it, I mean, obviously we've set this up, most all of the phyla appear suddenly. And phyla, ladies and gentlemen, are the largest category of classification other than kingdom in the animal and plant kingdoms. Practically all the phyla appear in one layer. Is that what you'd expect from evolution? Boom! All the phyla appear? That's not what I'd expect. Here's the picture I'd expect if I were an evolutionist. Maybe one phylum appears, and then from it evolve others, and then others, and then others. Isn't that what you'd think? That's not what you get. You see the contrast? Here's what you'd think Darwinians would predict. Here's what you get. There are 52 to 54 phyla. 40 to 42 of them originate in the Cambrian without question. Another 12 are also believed. These over here are believed to have originated there. And if that's the case, all but one phylum in one geologic age. All of them right in here. Now, folks, that is exactly the opposite of what evolution would predict. But that's what you observe. Looks to me like sudden appearance of complex forms of all kinds. Look, if the phyla appeared, that means you've got all the major differences between organisms already there. And from there, it's fine-tuning. And besides that, here's the Cambrian with all these different phyla that appear suddenly. What about the 1.5 supposed billion years of missing fossil evidence that went from single cells up to all these? There is essentially zero evidence in the pre-Cambrian. Oh, there's a few little things they've claimed, like you were mentioning on the Mars, that there may be some identification of single cells. There's a few fossils out there that they say this is a single-celled organism, but there's hardly any. There's certainly not sufficient evidence to show a fossil record of single cells leading up to all these complex things that suddenly appear in the Cambrian. It is absolutely missing. And we're not just talking about missing a little branch in the tree. We're missing the whole trunk! A third great feature of the fossil record is fossil stasis. That means they basically stay the same. As you dig through the fossil record, you see a fossil appear, and then it basically stays the same, and then it becomes extinct. That's basically what happens. That's a common feature of the fossil record. And the fourth one is, fossils are fully formed when they first appear. I mean, you dig up a fossil, it's there, it's fully formed. Those four features, ladies and gentlemen, do not support the evolutionary view of life. They support sudden appearance view, which better supports intelligent design. Here's a picture I took out of another biology textbook. You would think from this picture that this is what the fossil record represents. It's got all these different creatures, and their fossil record demonstrates that we're all related in this single tree of life all the way back to the single-celled organism. You'd think that, but I can tell you this picture is far from a fact. It's an interpretation of facts. And so what are the facts? Here's a quote from a man who's a thoroughgoing evolutionist. Who is he? Stephen Jay Gould, the one I quoted from in the beginning. 1977, Evolution's Erratic Pace. This should be pace. The extreme rarity of transitional forms in the fossil record persists as the trade secret of paleontology. The evolutionary trees that adorn our textbooks have data. What's another word for data? Facts. Only at the tips and nodes of their branches. The rest is inference, however reasonable, not the evidence of the fossils. You listening? Where's the hard facts? Let me show you the picture. There are the hard facts. At the tips and nodes of the branches. That's the only place you have fossils. So how do you get all those lines? You draw them yourself. That's how you get them. They are inference. And my question to you would be, if that's all the evidence you have, how do you know there's a single tree? How do you know they're in the forest? In fact, folks, the fossil record much better supports a forest than a single tree of life. Much better. You see, there's only this kind of little creature, these kinds of creatures, these kinds of creatures. They're not kin to each other. They're distinct. They have the potential to vary within limits. But that's it. Folks, the fossil record supports distinct kinds of creatures that are not kin to each other. Unless you've got a vivid imagination. And what they do is fill in the gaps here with their imagination. No, it's with the worldview they've already established before they ever start looking. So what are interpretations of these? First, some people say there's an imperfect record. We're never going to get enough fossils because a lot of things don't fossilize. And they're right. A lot of things don't fossilize. Do you know where you find most fossils? In previously things that were underwater. Sedimentary rock. That's where you find most fossils. So, isn't it true that a lot of things aren't going to be buried underwater? Sure. So there are a lot of places you're not going to find fossils, and you're not certainly going to find even ones that are buried a lot of times because they decay, they go away, they don't fossilize. Yeah, it's imperfect. But folks, after 150 years of searching and 250,000 species and many more waiting to be discovered while they're sitting there in museums, don't tell me we don't have enough fossils to get the big picture here. I don't believe it for a minute. Imperfect record is not a good answer. How about incomplete search? No, sir, that was Darwin's answer back in 1859. You can't say that anymore. Well, how about Stephen Jay Gould's answer? He called on punctuated equilibrium. He tried to admit now what everybody knows. There aren't any transitional fossils, hardly at all. He says it's the trade secret of paleontology. And he said, I'm putting it out in the open now, but I have an explanation for it. Punctuated equilibrium. Let me try to explain that to you. It's the most interesting theory ever been presented because there's no way to test it. Here's what he said. The reason you don't find transitional fossils is because in the fossil record, what happened is mostly things stay the same. You see all these vertical lines? That's fossil stasis. They stay the same. And then, over a short period of time, you see one of these horizontal lines right here? You get a burst of change that happens relatively quickly in time. So it's like a horizontal line in an isolated population, and it happens so quickly they don't leave fossils. See? So it's punctuated. You get rapid changes over a relatively short period of time in isolated populations. The evolution takes place all right, but it happens relatively quickly and not sufficiently to leave fossils behind. And so that's why there's so many empty spaces in the fossil record. Well, folks, if it happens so rapidly that it doesn't leave fossils, then you're never going to find the fossils. And if it happens so rapidly and nobody was there to observe it, you can't ever test it whether that really happened or not. So punctuated equilibrium is an outright guess to try to fit the evidence to your theory and no way to test it. That's not a very good theory, in my opinion. But do you know Gould and his cohorts got written up in the 1970s and 80s as the greatest breakthrough in the history of mankind? Because they now made up something that actually fits the fossil record better to what we really see. But it doesn't answer anything. What do you mean, sudden change? Are you trying to tell me that something automatically, quickly changed from a rabbit to a turkey? And so quickly that we don't have any fossils documenting how that happened? That's back to the hopeful monster theory. And he doesn't believe that. Gould still believes in Darwin's basic view of small-scale changes over long periods of time. He's just trying to make it short enough that you didn't get any fossils left. It's pitiful. That's what that is. Why not say somebody designed these things and they're left behind to show us the evidence of design? I mean, that fits so much better with the evidence than anything else anybody's proposed. But no, that's out. Because we're not letting design's foot in the door. So, Stephen Jay Gould's second great class of evidence, the direct evidence for large-scale changes. No, people, we have the direct evidence of fossils. To say they changed from one to the other over time is an interpretation that doesn't fit the facts. His nature of evidence, which he says we misunderstand. No, I don't misunderstand it, sir. The problem is it doesn't support your view. And this second great class of evidence, in my view, ladies and gentlemen, the jury, is totally destroyed. I hope you see why. No real evolutionist, says Mark Ridley in his 1981 article called Who Doubts Evolution? No real evolutionist, whether gradualist or punctuationist, uses the fossil record as evidence in favor of the theory of evolution as opposed to special creation. Nobody uses this. This does not mean that the theory of evolution is unproven, but nobody uses the fossil record to try to prove it. Do you know that's a flat-out lie? Of course people use the fossil record. I just quoted you from G.A. Kirkett. He says it's the best evidence there is. Ridley says nobody uses that. Well, let's compare what Ridley said. Well, here's another part of his quote. The gradual change of fossil species has never been part of the evidence for evolution. In the chapters on the fossil record and the origin of species, Darwin showed that the record was useless for testing between evolution and special creation because it has great gaps in it. The same argument still applies. Thank you, Mr. Ridley. You're right. But that's not what Darwin said. Look what Darwin said about it. The number of intermediate varieties which have formerly existed on Earth must be truly enormous. Why, then, is not every geological formation, every stratum full of such links? Geology assuredly does not reveal any such finely graduated organic chain. And this, perhaps, is the most obvious and gravest objection which can be urged against my theory. That's what Darwin said. Ridley says nobody's ever used that as evidence one way or the other. Shame on him. No, what he needs to say is, the evidence is pitiful for the theory I'm trying to support. He said, you can't use it one way or the other. Oh, yes, you can. And it's all against it. And I'm going to close this lecture with a good quote from Mark Twain. The guy could really hit the nail on the head sometimes. Now, if I wanted to be one of these ponderous scientific people and let on to prove what had occurred in the remote past by what has occurred in a given time in the recent past, or what will occur in the far future by what has occurred in recent years, what an opportunity is here. Geology never had such a chance, nor exact data to argue from, nor development of the species either. Glacial epochs are great things, but they are vague, ladies and gentlemen, vague. And so he says, please observe. In the space of 176 years, the lower Mississippi has shortened itself 242 miles. That's an average of a trifle over 1 mile and a half, or in a third, per year. Therefore, any calm person who is not blind or idiotic can see that in the old Oolitic Silurian period, just a million years ago next November, the lower Mississippi was upward of 1,300,000 miles long and stuck out over the Gulf of Mexico like a fishing rod. I love it. And by the same token, any person can see that 742 years from now, the lower Mississippi will only be a mile and three quarters long, and Cairo, Illinois, and New Orleans will have joined their streets together and will be plodding comfortably along under a single mayor and a mutual board of aldermen. There's something fascinating about science. One gets such wholesale returns of conjecture out of such trifling investment of fact. I love it. That's a good way to end this particular discussion. And I would say to you, in terms of the fossil record, we have an awful lot of conjecture based on the investment of a relatively insignificant amount of fact to support the theory. I think the fossil record is the poorest line of evidence for Darwin's theory of general evolution. I hope you see why I said that. God willing, in the morning, we're going to talk about the origin of man. Now we're getting down to where you really want to know. Where did we come from? And I'm going to deal with the fossil record as it relates to humans in the morning, in the first lecture. In the afternoon, we're going to turn our attention to the book by Michael Behe called Darwin's Black Box. And I'm calling it The Argument from Complexity. Absolutely fascinating because it's full of chemistry. So I hope you can be there for both of those. And if not, they're being recorded, of course, and you can get them later. All right. Well, we're supposed to have questions and answers, so let's see what we have at this juncture. All right. First question, what happened to the trilobites and other so-called prehistoric animals in the fossil record, also miniature horses? What happened to the trilobites? Did you know that trilobites are considered signal fossils? In other words, they are the fossil that identify the Cambrian layer. If you found a trilobite, you found a Cambrian layer, so they say. They're identifying fossils. There's so many of them associated with the Cambrian layer of rock that it is called a signal fossil for that layer. And they don't, as far as I'm aware, those particular creatures have become extinct. So if you ask me what happened to them, they became extinct. Like, did you know how many thousands of creatures that formerly lived are now extinct? The great majority of fossils that have been found are now extinct. The great majority. Most creatures that formerly lived aren't here anymore. Did you know that? You know what an evolutionist says about that? He says, that indicates to me this wasn't any plan of God. He let all these things die. Why would he make things so they could become extinct? Do you hear what I'm saying? Yeah. Good answer. He wanted to kill all of us at one time too, didn't he? Yeah. Well, from the perspective of a Bible believer, our answer is there was a fall because of sin, which changed everything. And you know that there's evidences of change in Scripture, don't you? After the fall. So, that would be the answer we would give as Christians. I'd never say that in a scientific lecture, however, you understand, because that's not a sufficient answer. I would just say an intelligent designer could have designed things in such a way that some things that were in existence are better off not being in existence now. He cleansed this place for various reasons. And that's a perfectly legitimate answer. So what happened to trilobites? They became extinct. Miniature horses did too, I expect. What happened to the trilobites and other so-called prehistoric animals in the fossil record that no longer exist? That's what I just asked, wasn't it? Okay, I was repeating that question. There were two of them with the same question. Where does the scientific community currently stand with respect to punctuated equilibrium? Here's where I hear most people talking. They think Darwinian mechanism is still in existence. It's still the best answer. Period. And that punctuated equilibrium only gives us an additional way of accounting for the lack of fossils. But it doesn't account for anything, folks. You still have to deal with the evolutionary process. Punctuated equilibrium doesn't tell you how it happened. It just tells you it happened so fast you didn't get fossils. The only mechanism anybody has is mutations acted on by natural selection over a long period of time, gene pool shifts, and all those things. It's the same thing we've been saying all along. So punctuated equilibrium hasn't done anything of explanatory value. But folks still use it and jump on it as something that helped us a lot. I suggest it didn't help us any. How do you answer the idea that the duck-billed platypus is a transitional species? Duck-billed platypus is a weird character, isn't it? It has a duck bill. Somebody tell me about that creature. It has a duck bill. I mean, that's obvious. A bill like a duck. What else does it have? It nurses its young like a mammal. It lays eggs like a reptile. And it has a big old tail, right? Like a beaver. It's the most confused creature ever was. And I'll tell you what an evolutionist can't explain. Here's what I do. I turn it back on him. You tell me it's a, what do you say? A transitional species. What's it transitioning to? He doesn't know where he's going. You can't call that a transitional species. He's a unique creature for all time. He's not going anywhere. Tell me what he's transitioning from and what he's transitioning to. They don't know what to do with that creature. He's his own unique type. And I'll tell you what else I'd say. What we've got on Earth is distinct groups of creatures that are not kin to each other. That's what the evidence supports. You go dig at the chemistry of it, and you'll find it's the same at the chemical level. Distinct groups that are not kin to each other, that are equidistant from all other creatures. Yeah, there's a lot of weird creatures in Australia, aren't they? Look, I think there is some evidence on Earth for populations getting isolated and evolving along a certain direction. Listen, I've already said to you, if you ask me, am I an evolutionist, I say yes and no, like any good politician. I believe in the limited theory of evolution, special theory. I think the evidence supports it tremendously. And if you deny that, you've got all kinds of problems. So I hope you are an evolutionist in that sense. Well, it could, but it depends on how far you take that. You know, adaptation can give you varieties. I'm not so sure you can't even produce a new species by that mechanism. Species is a man-made definition, ladies and gentlemen. I don't know exactly where to draw those lines. I know biblically, what did God say in Genesis 1? He made them to reproduce after their species, right? No, kind is the Bible word. And if you look that word up and its usage in the Old Testament, you'd be hard-pressed to identify kind as a species. In many instances, it's much broader than that. The Bible isn't that specific about what that kind is. So what I argue with folks is this. God created certain types of creatures. They can vary within limits, and that's it. And the evidence in the natural world supports that very strongly. Exactly where to draw those lines, you know, one of the things they say is you people never do any science. You creationists, all you do is criticize other people's science. You know what I'd suggest? Let's get a research project going on the limit of genetic change. I know. But do you think anybody's researching that? Nobody is, and nobody will fund it because they believe in the evolutionary viewpoint. They're not going to fund research that's trying to show the limit of genetic change. I think it'd be an excellent thing to do, though, because then we'd figure out evolution's not right in the first place. And we could change our whole worldview and get busy doing good science. This man's opinion. We need to be doing genetic studies on the limits of genetic change. That'll help us as we try to define new drugs. Just because you think design happened doesn't mean you stop doing science. People, the folks who invented science, were believers in God. Don't forget. Some of the greatest scientists that ever lived were firmly convicted there was a God. How'd we get off from duckbill platypuses onto that? I'm not sure. I think they're distinct creatures that don't come from anywhere else. Let's see. I think I answered all those. You got some more? What role do catastrophes serve as an explanation of many of the phenomena we see in the fossil record? Look, folks, there is abundant evidence for catastrophes all over the place. Folks didn't used to talk about that very much. But there are lots of evidence for catastrophes. Is there evidence worldwide for a single worldwide flood that's absolutely irrefutable? No, not that I know of. It's because the record changes so drastically over time. To have that single record everywhere on earth that says, yes, there was a big flood everywhere, would be very unusual. Are there records of tremendously terrible floods in lots of places? Yes, there are. And of destruction. I told you, most fossils are found in sedimentary rock. Sedimentary rock is rock laid down under water. And you find those on tops of mountains. Did you know that? Sea creatures on tops of mountains suggest there might have been underwater at one time. Since mountain ranges have those kinds of fossils on them. Now, do I have a good explanation for all that, exactly how all that happened? No, I don't. But yes, there's lots of evidence for catastrophes in the fossil record. Okay, what are phyla? Okay, I need a board for that. Where's my markers? Are they? Okay. I'm not seeing them. Are they up here? Oh, here they are, back behind here. Okay. Who's taking biology right now? Anybody? Because I need your help. I can't remember all this stuff. The highest classification of organism is kingdoms. Actually, some argue there's one above that, but we're not going to worry about that. Kingdoms. There's the animal kingdom and the plant kingdom, and then there's the kingdom of the single-celled organisms. Okay? Kingdoms. The next one under that is phyla. Excuse me. Somebody says, what's a phylum? Phyla is plural. Phylum is singular, isn't it? So what's a phylum? It's a classification of organisms at the very high level. So one of the phyla is vertebrata. Are we in that? Yes, we are, because we have vertebrata. So the phylum vertebrata is all the creatures on earth that have a backbone. Well, isn't that a huge... Aren't there a lot of things in that one? That's a huge classification. So it is a way of classifying organisms at a very high level. Includes lots of things. Now, this is where I need help. What comes under phylum? You remember, Luke? Class. I'm going to take your word for it. What's next? Order. Good. I'm so glad we have folks helping me here. Next. Family. And then genus, right? And then species. So see, this is the lowest level of classification. Species. What is our species? Homo sapiens, right? Homo is the genus. Sapiens is the species. So Homo sapiens. Most organisms are named by naming their genus and their species. Homo sapiens. Well, that's the lowest level of classification. But look, Homo sapiens belong to a family. They belong to an order. They belong to a class. And they belong to the phyla vertebrata. We're all have backbones. But there are lots of other creatures that are in this same phylum with us, because all of these different classifications fit under it. So did I answer that question for you? And here's what I'm saying to you. This is how we presented the word phylum in this lecture. All of the major phyla appear in the Cambrian layer in the fossil record. That means every major classification of all living things appear in that one geologic layer. That's not what evolution would predict, folks. That's what intelligent design would predict. Now, are there details about that I don't know how to explain? There absolutely are. But the general picture supports intelligent design better than it does the theory of evolution. Okay, you have another? Well, I'm getting trapped in my own devices here. All right, let's see. How much agreement is there among the scientific community about the age of these discovered fossils? Excellent question. How much have the estimates for the age of the Earth and or these fossils changed over the years? Well, those are big questions. Let me ask this one first. Did man coexist with dinosaurs? That's an interesting question. I recently did more research on that subject than I've ever done in my life and presented a lecture on it. So I have a whole lecture on that subject if you're interested sometime. But my conclusion was there are a number of lines of evidence that would support the idea that dinosaurs and humans coexisted. It is not so much the fossil record, though. From what I've learned, there have not been real solid finds in the fossil record that indicate humans and dinosaurs coexisted. Maybe you've heard of the Paluxy Riverbed in Texas. I used that in a debate in 1983, and I got slaughtered. Because the guy was well prepared on that subject, much better than I, and showed all kinds of reasons why that evidence of supposed human footprints and dinosaur footprints in the same rock layers are bogus. Since that time, I've never used that argument again. You know, fool me once, fool me twice. I did go to the Paluxy Riverbed for the first time this past summer and looked at some of it myself. It was certainly not convincing to me. Say it again. What the man claimed was that those supposed human footprints in the first place weren't human. In the second place, some of them were clearly doctored. And in the third place, they were not likely in the same layer with the others. And I don't know enough about it to answer all those arguments, but I do know this. I don't want to use weak arguments that are easy to answer. So I don't know of good fossil record evidence that dinosaurs and humans existed at the same time, but I do know a number of other lines of evidence, like pictures on caves all over the world, the remains of little figurines that have been found by the thousands in lots of places where humans evidently made images of these creatures that are clearly like the dinosaur fossils that we find. And, of course, stories in the records of humankind that speak of these things. And in the Bible, where do you think we would go? The book of Job is one place, and of course there are disagreements about what the behemoth is in Job and Leviathan. I think it's a distinct possibility. Those were dinosaur-type creatures spoken of by Job in one of the oldest books in the Old Testament. And then in Genesis, you know, he speaks of sea creatures and animals that were created of all kinds. So, I mean, there's room for that. in the biblical account? I don't think so. I never talk about it much. It really isn't critical to the intelligent design argument, in my view. Oh, I do too. You hear what he said? Yes. He said the biochemistry is the best line of approach. I really think it is the most powerful argumentation we can make today. All right, now back to this about the age. How much agreement is there among scientific community about the age of those discovered fossils? Well, let me say this to you very clearly, and you don't misunderstand this. You cannot date fossils back to millions of years. Are you listening?
Yes.
Fossils are the leftovers of something that was once living, right? So they are carbon, water-based things. The only radioactive substance that you can use to date those things directly is carbon-14. Because it is a radioactive form of carbon. If you could extract some carbon-14 from that fossil, which you often cannot, that's the first problem. But if you could extract a carbon sample from it and use carbon-14 to date it, folks, the half-life of carbon-14 is only 5,200 years. You know what half-life means? Let me try to illustrate that to you. I need an eraser. That doesn't erase very well. Am I using the wrong thing? Looks like not the right kind of eraser, maybe. It's the only eraser back here. We'll do the best we can. All right. Here's the best way to say it. Here's a chunk of carbon-14. Here's half of it. The half-life is the amount of time it takes for half of carbon-14 to go away. What happens is carbon-14 turns into a different substance by natural radioactive decay. So it becomes something else. It eventually ends up as nitrogen, which is not important to this discussion, but the fact is it's not carbon-14 anymore. So, its half-life is 5,240 years. Plus or minus, you know, that's not exact. Roughly 5,200 years. That means in 5,200 years, you've lost half of what you had to start with. In another 5,200 years, you've lost half of that. So what do you have left relative to the beginning? One quarter, right? You have one fourth of it left. In another 5,200 years, you've lost half of that. So you'd be down to one-eighth, wouldn't you? In another 5,200 years, you're down to one-sixteenth, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So look, over four half-lives, you're down to one-sixteenth what you had before. That's 20,000 years. If you go a couple of more half-lives, you're down to one-thirty-second, one-sixty-fourth, and then one-one-hundred-and-twenty-eighth, and so on. Folks, you don't have enough left to even measure. You see what I'm saying? You had a little enough to start with. But if you go five half-lives, you don't have anything left. There's nothing left to measure. So carbon-14 is only valid to about 25 to 30,000 years. Some people want to push it to 50,000 years. Okay, give me 50,000 years. That's a long way from a million. Right? So have you heard folks say that this fossil is a million years old? You certainly have. It's on the radio and it's in headlines. Tomorrow morning, I'm going to talk to you about fossils related to human evolution. They're claiming they're up to 5, 6, 7 million years old. The fossil cannot be dated back that far, people. There's no way to do it. So how do you date a fossil back to 5 million years old? Let me tell you how it's done. They found it in a layer of rock. Underneath this rock, they take the rock that's above it, and they date the rock. Yeah. I don't think people realize that. They date the rock that in which that fossil was found, not the fossil. And rocks have in them materials that have longer half-lives, like uranium, like potassium. They claim that potassium's like half-life is 1.5 billion years. And it's an interesting thing about that. They say the rate of decay of potassium is 1.5 billion years. I wonder who counted that. You know, all they can do is go by the rate they can measure now and assume that it kept going to the same rate for 1.5 billion years. You think there might be a little flaw in that issue? One of the real issues here is whether the rates have remained constant throughout time over billions of years. We don't know that. That's an assumption. Maybe a valid assumption, but it's an assumption nevertheless. Well, if you can date the rock using potassium argon, you have a much longer half-life to work with. Instead of 5,240 years, you got 1.5 billion. So you can go several half-lives in, can't you? And if there's some left, that means it has to be at least this old. That's the point. So, yes, sir. Please.
Isn't there some dishonesty with creationists about that too?
In what way are you thinking? And stalactites, yeah.
Yeah, but I've heard that now that they're different compositions than what they're finding like in the rock and stuff.
Uh-huh. I would say to you, yes, I've heard some creationist arguments that are not valid. Absolutely, I have. And let me tell you where I am, because I think that's probably what everybody wants to know. Because everybody tries to keep pushing me. How old is the earth? And how old is human? How old are humankind? I'll tell you, I don't know. That's just where I am. Here's my challenge. There are lots of things in the natural world that indicate or seem to indicate that things are extremely old. I have to be honest enough to admit that. There are quite a few things like that. There are other things that seem to indicate the earth is relatively young. Both of them are based on rates. And they both have to assume constant rates. And neither one of those can be determined exactly for sure. So, I'm going to ask God one of these days. But I'll tell you what I'm not going to do. Which some people do who are Bible believers, for example. I'm switching gears now. I'm talking about the Bible. I'm not going to go to Genesis 1 and try to force long ages on Genesis 1. No way. Because the most natural, logical understanding of Genesis 1 and the use of its words there does not allow for billions of years. Period. Those days there, the most logical understanding of those days is normal days. So I'm not going to try to force time on Genesis 1 and say those were really ages like some folks try to do. Because I'm not going there. And there's several reasons for that. One is I don't believe it's proper interpretation of Scripture. But the second is, what are we going to do when we come along here 100 years from now, if God allows this old world to last that long, and some scientist comes up with a discovery that shows how we can fit all this together in a short time frame? You know what I think? I think I'm going to ask God one day, Lord, you sure got me confused on this age thing. It sure looks like there's a lot of real old things there. How do you help? He's going to say, you stupid. That's really easy. Here's how. That's what I think. I think we just haven't figured it out yet. But I'll tell you what I'm not going to do. I'm not going to be dishonest with the evidence. You shouldn't be either. There is a lot of evidence that things are really old. So don't just go around with your head in the sand and say, no, that's not so. There is a lot of evidence that things are really old. I don't know yet how to deal with all of that, but I'm not forcing that upon Scripture. Okay? I think the Lord's going to help us one of these days understand all that. So that's where I am on it. I also do this. When an evolutionist tells me this rock is 4.5 billion years old, I go to his dating methods and show him how he doesn't know that with certainty at all, because every dating method in radioactive dating is based on three fundamental assumptions. One is the rate being constant. Another is that you can determine how much was there to start with. You know, you got to know how much we're to start with and how much there's now to determine how long it was. Don't you? Well, who was there to measure it? 10 billion years ago, nobody. And thirdly, you've got to assume there was no leakage, in or out, over 10 billion years, or 5 billion years, or 2.5 million years. That's not a very good assumption either, in my opinion. So all three assumptions have questions about them, which means the method is not absolute. So don't tell me that rock's 4.5 billion years old. Tell me it's the best guess you have based on the evidence in your hands. Don't tell me that's how old it is. That's what I do with it. Yes? Say it again.
Have you heard anything or any discussions about rates of mutations?
To help determine age?
Yeah, the number of mutations that have accumulated to determine the age type of cell.
In living things or non-living things?
In living things.
It'd almost have to be, wouldn't it? Mutations. And
some way to quantify
Yeah, his question is, can rates of mutations help us with age? The problem with it is, if you're going to go back very far into the fossil record, you'd have difficulty determining the number of mutations that had happened. You'd have to presume the present rate has been the case all the way back. It's the same issue, that rates of mutations have never changed. I'll tell you, there's a real interesting phenomenon. The flood itself that's described for us in Scripture was a dramatic event. And more things happened there than just water falling and coming up out of the earth. And it may have well been such a discontinuity that reset clocks of various kinds. I don't know. That's another thing I don't know the answer to. But could have reset mutation rates, for example, by various mechanisms. All right, maybe we've worn everybody out. You guys? Okay. Well, they don't give up, do they? Man. This is a good class. How do you explain the supposed increase in the complexity of life as you progress up the geologic column? I said I have a trouble with that. Here's how I answer that. I think that general trend from bottom to top is not as general as it looks on the surface, because in the first place, I erased it, but all the phyla appear in the Cambrian layer. That's upside down, folks. So that general trend is already upside down. See, but you do find more complex creatures higher than you do lower. There's no question about that. I say that's either limited change within those kinds, whatever that was created, that have allowed for a general increase in complexity within limits, or something to do in addition to that with the flood and the mechanism of deposition. I think a part of that column can be accounted for by that, but not all of it. Are you familiar with the supposed recent findings of soft tissues in fossils, and does this say anything about the age of these fossils? Yes, I am. There's an especially interesting one about a dinosaur fossil found up in South Dakota that had fossilized a lot of its soft tissue. You know what that speaks to? Catastrophe. You're not going to fossilize soft tissue unless it happened very suddenly. Right? Usually what you get is bones. So if you fossilize soft tissue, that thing had to be trapped in water and solidified very quickly, or you wouldn't have the soft tissue fossilized. So it speaks to catastrophe is what that does, which speaks to relatively recent. So, yes, I'm familiar with that, at least to that degree. Let's see. Already did that one. Yes. I'm free until tomorrow morning. But thank you for your good attention and your genuine interest in this subject. And I hope it's been of value to you. And here's what I really hope. I hope that folks get their minds tweaked enough you want to study more for yourself. Because we haven't touched the hem of the garment, folks. And you are fortunate, I'll repeat, you are fortunate to live in this century. Since 1950, there's been more learned that helps us investigate this subject than in all the previous history of mankind. And it's at your fingertips. And you can become such a fervent believer in God. And one thing I pray every time I do this series is that I have the capacity, to honor and glorify the great God that made us in such a way that everybody is in absolute awe of who He is. And we have less excuse than ever, ladies and gentlemen, of missing that there is a God who created us. There's no excuse. There wasn't any excuse in Romans 1. But there's less excuse now than ever of missing that there is an intelligent designer who made all that there is in the earth, in the land, in the sea, and in the skies. And I hope that our time together has in some small way magnified Him. And thank you for the privilege. I'll turn it over to you.